We have 2 weeks left in Exodus, believe it or not. We're going through Exodus in 12 weeks, and we have two left. And I think I can at least speak for myself. It's a book that has challenged and inspired. As we've been following and tracing the story of Moses and the nation of Israel from slavery in Egypt to deliverance through the Red Sea. And now in the last few weeks, we've been looking at God shaping and forming his people with his intentional care. And some of the stories that we've been reading about over the last few weeks, it's like heavenly bread delivered on the desert floor and water pouring forth from a rock and quail delivered in the evening. And then God providing his commandments as really a framework of what does it look like to be in right relationship with God and with one another. And then last week, as I mentioned earlier, we looked at the building of the tabernacle, which is really God, his display of himself on Mount Sinai, now housed in this place where he's accessible to the people in the middle of the camp, and how it foreshadows Christ's role as our high priest as he goes into the most holy place and presents the sacrifice of himself so that we have access to the Father. And I was sitting there last week kind of taking all of this in, all of these ways that God is shaping and forming his people, and I just had this thought, like it doesn't get any better than this. Like here is God blessing, providing for, caring for the people. What else should they do but just follow and obey him, right? But then I look at my own life and I look at our world and I'm like, well, yeah, it's not quite that simple, is it? We struggle to stay with obedience in the ways of the Lord. And that's really going to be our theme as we come to Exodus 32 today and the story of the golden calf and what happens to the people when there's an opportunity to go away from the framework of living that God had provided for the people. A few weeks ago, I shared my concern about our addictive society. And one of the examples that I used to kind of show or display an example of what this looks like is online sports gambling. And I shared about how like there's 40 states or so in the United States that have legalized online sports gambling, and that last year alone, $500 billion was bet online. Well, right around this time, as all of this news is coming out about sports gambling, there was a story about a guy named Amit Patel and him being sentenced into jail that I thought his story was incredibly interesting as it relates to all of this. Amit Patel grew up in a household with parents who had immigrated from India, and he grew up in a really strict household where academic excellence was demanded and required by his parents. And for the most part, all through high school and college, he succeeded in an overwhelming way, both athletically and scholastically in academics as well. Had good grades, always was toward the top of his class. But during his teenage years, his father died. And this kind of sent him down a dark path of drinking and drug use, and then eventually gambling. And the gambling really started through online poker. I don't know how many of you remember online poker was like the thing between like 2000 and 2010. And he would go online and he would just bet a few dollars at a time, and it made his mom mad. So he's on a cruise with his mom and his now stepdad. And on the cruise, there's an opportunity for a $100 buy-in poker game. And he asks his mom if she'll give him money to do the poker game. And she says no. Why? Because she knows about all those little credit card expenses that she's been paying for as he's gambling online for poker. But his stepdad slipped him a $100 bill. And he did really well in the poker tournament and made a lot of money. And that was really the thing that set it off for him. He was now becoming addicted to online poker and gambling. Well, eventually after college, Amit landed what he thought of as his dream job that combined his financial acumen with athletics. He worked in finance for the Jacksonville Jaguars, NFL football team. And he used his position in finance to come up with this elaborate money laundering scheme involving company credit cards that he used to fund his gambling addiction. And this went on for several years, and eventually he was caught and tried and jailed, and he's in prison for 6 years. He was just sentenced to jail a month ago. And the reason for this is because over the course of several years, he had amassed a debt of $22 million of online gambling that he had taken part in. And why all this is interesting to me is because he was interviewed about how did this all happen? Like, how did it snowball over time to go from $100 on a cruise to $22 million of debt, of losses? And from his prison cell, in an interview that he gave, this is what he said. He said, "I was battling with a secret addiction that nobody knew about. Everyone thought I was doing great, dandy. You know, on Instagram, they see you having fun. You're with your friends and family, but there's a mental demon inside, taking him away from the good life that he could have had towards something that is sinister and evil." And this idea of us kind of being drawn to things that ultimately lead to our destruction is a really key theme in Exodus 32. But to kind of understand the significance of Exodus 32, we have to know the backstory. And the backstory from Exodus 32 really happens in Exodus 24. Right before the instructions for the tabernacle that we looked at last week, before those were given, God had said to Moses, "Why don't you come up the mountain? I'd like to meet with you." And then he gives him the instructions for the tabernacle. But what happens on his way up the mountain is significant to understand Exodus 32. It says this toward the end of the chapter. To the Israelites, the glory of the Lord looked like a consuming fire on the top of the mountain. Then Moses entered the cloud as he went up the mountain. And he stayed on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. So in other words, Moses went through a wall of fire and disappeared. And he wasn't seen for 40 days in 40 nights. So you just have to have that in your back of your mind of how could these people become so disobedient to God? Their leader went through a wall of fire and disappeared. A lot of them probably thought he was dead. That's the context for Exodus 32, which is where we're going to be. We're going to look at verses 1 through 14. We'll talk about the whole chapter, but we're just going to read these first 14 verses because they really establish the framework for what we're talking about. The story continues. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, 40 days and 40 nights, they gathered around Aaron and said, "Come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him," which was true. He had literally, from their eyes, disappeared. Aaron answered them, "Take off the gold earrings that your wives, your sons, and your daughters are wearing and bring them to me." So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. He took what they handed him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then they said, "These are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, "Tomorrow there will be a festival to the Lord." So the next day the people rose early and sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings. Afterward, they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go down, because your people, whom you brought up out of Egypt, have become corrupt." Now, this is really interesting. Those of you that are parents, you'll understand this. When a kid is doing something that you don't like, sometimes you'll say to your spouse, "Yeah, that kid of yours, look what they're doing. That's your fault," right? That's essentially what God is saying to Moses. "These kids of yours, look what they're doing." But it's really like, God's the one who's been in charge of all of them, yeah? They have been quick to turn away from what I commanded them and have made themselves an idol cast in the shape of a calf. They have bowed down to it and sacrificed to it and have said, these are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. I have seen these people, the Lord said to Moses, and they are a stiff-necked people. Now leave me alone, so that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. Then I will make you, Moses, into a great nation. But Moses sought the favor of the Lord his God. Lord, he said, why should your anger burn against your people, whom you brought out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, it was with evil intent that he brought them out, to kill them in the mountains and to wipe them off the face of the earth? Turn from your fierce anger, relent, and do not bring disaster on your people. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, which is Jacob, to whom you swore by your own self, I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and I will give your descendants all this land I promised them, and it will be their inheritance forever. Then the Lord relented and did not bring on his people the disaster he had threatened. This is the word of the Lord. A powerful story. And one of the pieces of it that's really interesting to me, because we talked about this partially last week, is the gold. The gold that they used to form this golden calf. Where did it come from? These were people living in the desert. They were slaves before that. They had nothing. And so how were they, last week we talked about, how were they able to get gold into the tabernacle as God had designed it? Well, it all came from the Egyptians. The Egyptians had given them all this stuff on their way out to try and appease God. And so they were able to take all of these things with them. And so here we have gold being a sign of God's deliverance for the people, becomes the path for their disobedience. Really interesting. But to really understand the story, I think you have to see it as a retelling of another Bible story that happened before in the book of Genesis. It's kind of like a remake of a movie, which is popular today, or like the live action movie of an animated film. It's the same story, just told with different people and in a different way. It's what I describe as the fall part two. It's the fall in the Garden of Eden, part two. Verse 1 of Exodus 32, come, make us gods who will go before us. That's what the people say to Aaron. And there's a lot of similarity between Genesis 2 and 3 and Exodus 32. In Genesis 3, we have an animal, a serpent, who becomes the source of the temptation. In Exodus 32, we have an animal, a golden calf, is the center of temptation. In Genesis 3, Adam blames Eve for the problems to God. In Exodus 32, when he's confronted by Moses, Aaron blames the people and the fire. He just says, this thing came right out of here. Like, he had no involvement whatsoever. In Genesis 2 and 3 and in Exodus 32, the consequence for the sin of the people is the death of the people. In Genesis 3, we have brothers immediately after the fact who are trying to kill each other with Cain and Abel in Genesis 4. In Exodus 32, we see the Levite people go through the tribe, the nation of Israel, killing 3,000 people in one day. It causes consternation and frustration between people who were previously brothers. And then we also see a similarity. God strikes down the source of the temptation. In Genesis 3, he says, I will crush the serpent's head. And in Exodus 32, Moses takes the golden calf and he throws it back into the fire, destroying it. And so we see all these comparisons, and I put a chart together so that you can see some of these comparisons. A few more of them that I haven't already mentioned are grammatical things. We've already talked about the animal of the serpent, the calf. Adam blames Eve. Aaron blames the people. But in Genesis 2 and 3, it says that Eve saw the fruit on the tree and she took it. In Exodus 32, verses 4 and 5, it says Aaron took the gold and then that he saw the people worshiping other gods. And then in Genesis 2 as well, it says that Adam and Eve were naked and they were not ashamed. And the literal word in Exodus 32:1, when he's coming down the mountain slowly, it's taking him forever. He's been up there 40 days. The literal word would be Moses caused shame in taking so long to come down the mountain. So what I think Moses is doing in the way that he's writing this is trying to help us see that there is a corollary, a parallel between Genesis 2 and 3, the story of the fall, and Exodus 32, the story of the golden calf. And he's trying to help us see this connection so we can see similar themes that are true in Genesis 3 and are also true in Exodus 32 as well. And one of the things that I think we see is that passivity leads to disobedience. In Genesis, we see that with Adam very clearly. It was Adam in the garden who just did whatever Eve wanted, and then when he was confronted by God for it, said, well, it was actually Eve. She was the problem. And in Exodus 32, here at Mount Sinai, it's Aaron who just goes along with the people. Bring your gold here. I'll help take care of it. And he probably had good motivations, trying to kind of keep them at bay. He even says, we're gonna have a festival to the Lord. He's trying to like kind of twist their intentions to make them good. And his passivity then allows the people to get what they want. And then he blames the people for it after, when he was really the passive kind of bystander to the whole thing. Instead of Aaron being this blatant idolater, kind of like the people are, he is rather a pushover. He's the one that just allows things to happen because he's not willing to stand up to the people for what he knows is right. And by the end of the story, it says what happened during this festival that Aaron had put together to try and redirect things back to the Lord. It said at the end of the story that the people, in a sense, became unhinged. They indulged in revelry, is what the NIV translates that as. In other words, it was a giant party, just a huge, massive party. And it was so obnoxious and over the top that it says later on in Exodus 32 that the nearby nations, the enemies of Israel, saw what was happening and laughed. They laughed at them because they saw that they had become unhinged and had gone away from the way that they had lived before. And now for me, the thing that I notice in this story, the passivity of it is related to men who are not standing up and doing what's right, but allowing for disobedience to happen around them while doing nothing. And in some ways, in the case of Aaron, even enabling the disobedience to take place. So clearly, Exodus 32 has something to say to everyone about passive living and disobedience. But I want to, just for a second, address men only. Doesn't mean that this doesn't apply to women. I just want to say it more directly to men. Because it's in the story, these are men, Adam and Aaron, who are the passive people that allow for disobedience to take place. I want to just briefly address men and say this. The future of your family, your marriage, your children, your job, the future of this church will be determined by your involvement. And what I mean by that is it could be that your involvement is passive and you just kind of take a step back and whatever happens, happens. And you'll be the bystander observing it all. Or it could be that you take an active involvement and say, this is the way that God is leading us to live, and I'm going to be an example, and I'm going to bring other people with me to go that direction. It could be one way or the other, but your involvement will determine the future of all the things that you're involved with. God has determined and made up men to be that way. That's not to diminish the role of women, but to elevate the significance of men in determining the future of the people around them. And I know why men become passive. It can be intimidating to have to put yourself out there in front of other people. They might misunderstand you. They might not like what you have to say or what you have to do. They might misunderstand. They might not have the best. You might not think that you have the best intentions in mind. You might be questioned. To put yourself out there is to make yourself vulnerable to criticism and other concerns that people might have. But the flip side of this is that nothing good ever happens when men become passive. Nothing good ever happens. And we could summarize Exodus 32 and Aaron's involvement in saying passivity encourages iniquity, which is just another word for sinfulness, for disobedience. It would be easy for us as men to kind of look around at the world and say, like, well, here's all the problems that we see. But it's a whole nother thing. It's a whole other thing to lean in and say, I see those problems, but here's what I'm about. Here's what my life is about. And those people around me, I'm inviting you to follow behind me as I lead that way forward with my example and with my words. God calls men to humbly surrender themselves before the Lord and to ask him to kill their own self-willed intentions, to instead take on his, and to humbly go before the people around them and say, God has led me to lead us in this way, and to humbly, lovingly, carefully bring others with us. But what we see in Exodus 32 is the opposite of that, is passivity breeding disobedience. It's a fall garden-like story. And so it's kind of with that foundation in mind, I think we can then see the outcome of the people's disobedience in Exodus 32. And I think we could say it this way: you become what you worship. That's what I think we see here in verse 9 of Exodus 32. God says, I've seen these people, and they are a stiff-necked people. Now, God could have described the disobedience of the people in any number of ways, but this description, I think, is very intentional, because what he's wanting us to understand is they have become like the thing that they worship. What are they worshiping? A cow. What have they become like? A cow, a stiff-necked people. And you can actually even think of this story in cow-like terms. At the beginning of the story, the people are given freedom because Moses isn't there and Aaron's not doing anything. And so in their freedom, they eventually wander outside of the fence, the framework and the parameters that God had put in place for them. They wander beyond it. And so Moses has to come back as the lead shepherd, and he has to bring the people back into the fold, inside the gate. And then he has to then teach them again what it's like to operate within God's framework in the fence. The whole story can be understood in cow-like terms, in part because God wants us to see that they have become like the thing they worship. And this is a theme all throughout the Bible. In fact, a great one is Psalm 115, which is all about idolatry and people making idols and pursuing life outside of God's design. And then it summarizes it in Psalm 115, verse 8. Those who make them idols will be like them, and so will all who trust in them. Those who trust and make idols will become like them. They'll be a reflection of those things. And I was thinking this week, like, what's a good example of the way that idols in 2024 begin to shape us and mold us as people? And I think the best example that I could think of, at least, is our phones. Our phones. The average American spends 4.5 or 5 hours a day on their phone. If you have an iPhone, every Sunday you get a notification that you've probably turned off because it was too depressing, of how much screen time you spend on your phone per day. And I bet that number is largely depressing every week as you realize, wow, I really spent that much time on my phone? Yes, you did. 40% of teenagers, in a survey that just came out, 40% of teenagers self-admitted that they spend literally all the time on the phone. They're on the phone all the time. And what I think they mean by that when they're admitting that, it's not just that they're literally on their phones all day long, but that they're also thinking about it. Even when they're not using it, they're thinking about the things that are happening on that device all the time. And these phones are amazing. They allow us to be everywhere all at once, all the time. They have incredible capacity to connect us. You and I can stay connected even when we're not physically together. And there's an immense blessing that comes from that. You and I can know what's happening in the world at all the time, all the time. So it's not only a negative thing, even though I'm obviously talking about it in negative terms. We wouldn't be on these devices as much as we were if they didn't provide some obvious benefit to us. But think about the ways that they're shaping us and transforming us, because that's really the point of how this fits within Exodus 32. They provide benefits for us, but they also are causing our brains to be rewired in the way that we function so that we lack sustained attention spans. We cannot focus for very long on one thing, at least in part because we're used to being on devices where something is always changing. Something is always coming, a notification, a ding, a text, any sort, an email, all of those things. So we lack attention spans. And then they've also allowed us to be really efficient. We can get a lot done because there's a lot of things you can do on a phone in a short span of time. But the downside of this is that it makes us more restless and anxious because we get used to living at this quick pace of life that it becomes difficult to slow down and not always be efficient at accomplishing our tasks. So the things that we worship have a way of shaping us and molding us. That's exactly what one theologian says on a very similar theme. He says, people will always reflect something, whether it be God's character or some feature of the world. If people are committed to God, they will become like him. If they are committed to something other than God, they will become like that thing. Always spiritually inanimate and empty, like the lifeless and vain aspect of creation in which they have committed themselves. What he's saying is these things that we give ourselves to that are worldly and not of the Lord are lifeless and vain. They're empty. They have no sustaining value, and yet we give ourselves to them over and over. And after the people have done this in Exodus 32, God is talking to Moses. Moses can't see down at the bottom of the mountain because he's in the cloud with the presence of the Lord. And God lets Moses know about what's happening. And God is not happy. He is very angry at these disobedient people. And what we see here at the end of the passage is that sin has consequences. Disobedience to the Lord has consequences. This is what God says to Moses, verse 10. Now leave me alone. And that phrase, leave me alone, is kind of like God's way of saying, give me a reason to settle down. I need some space. Leave me alone so that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. Then I will make you, Moses, into a great nation. So God is saying, like, let's just get rid of these 2-3 million people. We'll do something with you instead, Moses. That's what God is saying. And Moses' response is really interesting. What he does is he draws God to remember the past. Look at the nation of people, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that you have made an agreement with, a covenant with. And then he literally just restates the covenant back to God about all the descendants that God had promised these people. And after Moses has said that, this is God's response. Verse 14. Then the Lord relented and did not bring on his people the disaster he had threatened. That is a really confusing verse. And it brings all sorts of questions that I have as I hear that. One question is, was God serious when he said that he was going to destroy them? And if Moses had not interceded and tried to remind God of who he was and what he had done before, was God going to follow through on destroying the people? And if God wasn't serious, then did Moses even need to say anything? Or was he just kind of a bystander in the story? And did Moses cause God to change his mind? All of these sorts of questions run around in my mind when I read Exodus 32:14. And I think the thing that I want to draw us to is twofold. One is the way in which Moses goes to God and what he says is highly important for us to understand. Because Moses does not go to God and just simply say, change your mind, God. He reminds God that he just wants God to be consistent with what he's done. It's not God, change your mind. It's God, be consistent. This is how you've been before. Continue to be that kind of God for us moving forward. But how do we understand God changing his mind and Moses interceding? How do we put these things together? Well, I have a quote from an Old Testament scholar on this verse that I think frames it really well. And then it's a little difficult to understand, so I'll try and explain it after I read it. Far from human intercession being an irritating but occasionally successful intrusion upon divinely prefabricated blueprints for history, convoluted phrase, I know, Moses' prayer becomes an integral part of the way God's sovereignty in history is exercised. That does not solve totally the mystery, but it puts it in its proper biblical perspective. Here's the key part that I want you to hear. God not only allows human intercession, God invites it and builds it into the decision-making processes of the heavenly council in ways we can never fathom. So what he's saying is that there's a mystery to this in a way that we're never going to truly be able to answer or understand. So if you were to ask me, did God change his mind? Do our prayers influence God to do something different than he had planned all along? There's a mystery to being able to answer that, that I cannot give you just a simple like, well, it says this in this verse, and so therefore, it's a mystery that we will not understand. But what he's trying to say, I think, gives us a clue of the right way to understand this. And I would say it in this way. God invites us to partner with him, and he accounts for us being part of what he's doing. He invites us, and he accounts for in his grand plan. He's inviting us to partner with us, with him, and he's accounting for us doing so. And he is engaging and causing things to move in light of those two realities. And so what that means, as you read through the end of the story, if you were to read the rest of Exodus 32, is sometimes God uses painful, difficult consequences to get the attention of the people. And at the end of the chapter, God sends a plague on the people. God's way to try and get their attention that the way that they were going is harmful and disobedient, to pull them back in. And I think of the C.S. Lewis quote where he says that pain is the megaphone that God uses to rouse a deaf and dying world. Does it mean that every painful situation in your life is caused by God? No, it doesn't mean that. But sometimes God will put painful situations into our lives to try and draw us back in. And that's really what is happening here in Exodus 32. God sees the people reaching for all the wrong things that have led them away from him. But what he also sees is their longings. What they're longing for is God and his presence. But what they're reaching for is gold, a golden calf. And think about that kind of principle at work in our lives as well. We're longing for intimacy, for connection, for partnership with other people, But what we're often reaching for is pornography and cheap ways of trying to give us the thing that we think we actually want. What we are longing for is fulfillment in life, but what we're reaching for is money as somehow the mechanism to give us what we want. We're longing for connection with one another, but we're reaching for our phones, cheap, fabricated means to the ends that we'll never receive. We're longing for purpose, but what we're reaching for is Netflix and entertainment and never-ending binge-watching shows that will never give us the thing that we actually want. And our society bears the marks of the consequences of reaching for all the wrong things and not staying in tune with the deep longings and how we can actually have them fulfilled. We're longing for God, but we're reaching for idols in all of their various forms. One of the phrases that I used at the beginning to help us understand this story is "you become what you worship." And throughout the morning, I've only talked about that in negative terms. But the truth is that you can think of that in a positive term as well. If you become what you worship is just a simple fact, then what you worship is the thing that you need to consider. And much of our examples in our society are the wrong things, and so therefore we're being transformed in the wrong ways. But you can also be transformed by worshiping the Lord and putting Him front and center. I think of the New Covenant foreshadowing in Ezekiel 36, where God says that I will give you a new heart and put my spirit within you, and I will change your heart of stone to a heart of flesh. It's a foreshadowing of the transformation that God wants to do when somebody surrenders to Him. And so it's not only a negative example, there's also a positive transformation that takes place when you worship the Lord, because you become like what you worship. And God is shaping you to be a greater reflection of who He is when you surrender yourself to Him. A great New Testament verse that highlights this principle is 2 Corinthians 3:18, which says this: "And we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being changed into His likeness from one degree of glory to another." And so we can be encouraged and take heart, because despite our difficulties in life, despite our disobedience of turning to other things, God is not a distant, passive bystander of your life, but He is a God who is actively involved. And when you give your life to this God, He will change you from one level of glory to another, to be a greater reflection of who He is. We are being transformed into His likeness. So the encouragement that I think Exodus 32 gives us from a negative example is that your transformation is not simply possible, it's inevitable. And the question is, what will you be transformed by? Your transformation is not just possible, it's inevitable. Who you are in 5 years will be different than the person that's here right now. And the question is, who is it that will shape you? Or what is it that will shape you? And it's kind of with that question in your mind that I'd like to go to the Lord in prayer. God, we turn to You recognizing that I think in this story we are probably in some part Aaron, but we are definitely the people, the nation. And we're in need of a Moses-like figure, an intercessor, somebody to stand in the gap. And we recognize that Jesus is that person. We are the sinful, disobedient, golden calf-building people in need of intercession. And Jesus has met that need. And so we are here, God, in worship, in praise, thinking of you and all that you've done through your Son to make it so that we can not only just be in relationship with you, but be changed and transformed to become a greater reflection of who you are. And God, I recognize that especially when difficult circumstances come in life, we can turn aside from the path that you have called us to. We can get outside the gate in the way that we live. And you are very kindly, gently drawing us back in. So we thank you for this morning. May we hear that gentle, caring voice calling us back home. Meet us in this place. Shape us into who you long for us to be. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.